couple of ongoing events, affairs in the life of the village that hold that name up in front of us. 200 sewing machines for the Ovambo Kavango Lutheran Church. Did all of you know that there was an Ovambo Kavango Lutheran Church before this meeting? It's amazing. A project of providing books, theological books of all things, for a library. It's there all the time. Why? What's the uniqueness of this place? Where is it? What's going on that makes it worth our continuing consideration during the course of this this time in the middle of the Cascades? What does it have to do with churches in North America? Perhaps all of you, you know, I hope this doesn't turn out to be the convinced talking to the converted or something like that, and we've got everybody here who knows what's going on. I hope we have some people here that know what's going on, however, so that that there really is some coarse conversation going on. But what I would hope is that everybody who's here would do one thing as a result of this, and that is, whatever you learn about Namibia, take it upon yourself to spread it to some other person that's in the village that's not here tonight, so that the knowledge can really be spread far and wide. I've asked Mary and Larry to kind of move sort of to this end, so that we at least have some real starters on the discussion. And Mary's going to kick it off by presenting some kind of basic information to you all about this place and this circumstance. Mary's done that a lot in the past. I know Larry has some connections and to some of his national contexts. And I've been a participant since its inception in the Lutheran Coalition on Southern Africa, a inter-Lutheran church, parachurch organization in the United States that's been trying to deal in Lutheran churches with the issues of justice in South Africa, and that flops us over into Namibia, as you'll find out really simply. Mary, it's yours.
Okay, I became very interested in Namibia when I was a representative of the ALC to Lutheran Council. And one day in the late 60s, Ed May, who heads the World Community Desk at the Lutheran Council in New York, started telling the 40 people there about what was going on in this country. I had never heard of it before. When Ed was done with his hour presentation, I could not get up off my chair. I was weeping. I don't know when I have been grabbed by a situation more, or felt more angry, or why was I the age that I was and had never heard of Namibia before. I couldn't believe that stuff had been going on. Now it makes me wonder what is going on in other parts of the world that I'm not aware of, that we aren't being told. So I have taken it upon myself in the past 12 years to share with as many people as I can my concerns about Namibia. If you have one of these blue sheets, turn it over where the map is, just so we set Namibia in context of Africa. It used to be called Southwest Africa. It borders on South Africa, Botswana, Angola. And if you look at this portion of the map over to the left of the paper, you'll see that there are places like Ovambo, Kavango, Bushmanland, Hereroland, Eastern Caprivi, and so forth. These are separate Bantustans or reservations. And so when we talk about the Ovambo Kavango Lutheran Church, if you look at the top of the map, you see those two Bantustans where there are two different races of blacks, two tribes. They have been put on these reservations, and that's where the majority of the Lutherans in Namibia live. But I want to go back a little bit. I'm told I have about 20 minutes or so to discuss this with you before we open it up. So I want to start with the country of South Africa first, who is responsible for the oppression and the misery that is going on in Namibia right now. When Columbus was discovering America, Vasco da Gama was sailing around the bottom of the continent of Africa, discovering the Cape of Good Hope. Nothing much was done except the Dutch heard about it and wanted to set some sort of a colony down at the Cape of Good Hope. Englishmen had heard about it and they tried to get a bunch of prisoners to establish a colony down there. That didn't work very well, and actually the Dutch were much more successful. It was a new route to India, just like Columbus was searching for when he discovered America. And so by the mid-1700s, there were 15,000 Dutch people who were living in South Africa. Those Dutch people that live there are called Afrikaners. So when you hear the term Afrikaner, that is not a black that lives in South Africa or Namibia. It is a person of Dutch descent. They were kind of divided into three groups. There were some Dutch who stayed around the Cape Town area. They were the merchants, the traders. Then there were what we call the Boers or the Boeren. They were farmers, wine and grain farmers. And then you had a group called the Trekboeren. And those were the people that moved away from the coastland and went up into the central part of South Africa, displaced the blacks, conquered them, married them, and the result of marriage between blacks and whites in Southern Africa, in South Africa, and in Namibia, those people are called coloreds. They have a higher status than the blacks. So the blacks are at the bottom of the totem pole, then the coloreds, or the Indians and Asians, and of course the white people are at the top. Pretty soon, well not pretty soon, I'll get my dates here, about the time of the Revolutionary War in the United States, Britain conquered the Cape of Good Hope and took over the government for that part of Africa. There, the South African history so parallels that of the United States. When the Dutch started moving, it's called the Great Trek, and it was just like our westward movement. The Boer War, which finally took place in the early 1900s and late 1800s, the Boer War that you've heard of was between the British and the Dutch, and that was almost like our Revolutionary War. The result, the peace that resulted after the Boer War, was what caused the formation of the Union of South Africa as we know it today. So that gives you a little bit of history of how the whites got into Africa, how the coloreds were called, or how they developed. If you look on your sheet again and turn it over from the map, you'll see that I've listed some dates. I'm not going to read all these. If you're interested, you can look at them, but I am going to point out a few things. Germany finally came over. I'm going to move from South Africa up to Southwest Africa and talk about the fact that when Germany took over Southwest Africa, a lot of Lutheran missionaries came down and colonized, or they were practically a colony, but the Germans were the ones that first brought Christianity to Namibia. And the German flag flew over Namibia, or Southwest Africa as it was known, for many years. When World War I came and Germany was defeated, this country of Southwest Africa was assigned by the League of Nations to the country of South Africa as a sacred trust. South Africa was given a mandate to govern Southwest Africa for the best possible use of its resources for the people of that country. It was a sacred trust, and the League of Nations trusted South Africa to do this. South Africa realized very quickly that Namibia was a very, very wealthy country. The most diamonds in the world are found in Namibia. Copper, oil, it was a country rich in resources. And South Africa became very greedy for these resources, and instead of governing Namibia or Southwest Africa, as it was still known then, in the best interests of that country, they simply took it over and were ruling it for the best interest of the whites in South Africa. One of the things they did was to set up the apartheid system. A speaker in the United Nations recently said the apartheid system is universally recognized as constituting the most brutal and violent form of human exploitation and suffering unsurpassed in the contemporary world. Before I talk about the apartheid system and how it affects the people in Namibia, I want to give you a few statistics. Namibia is about the size of Montana, or twice as big as the state of California. There are 1.5 million people that live in Namibia. 80% of them are black. 10% are colored or Asian, and 10% are white. But this 10% of the whites own 87% of the land. All the diamonds, all the copper mines are owned by whites. They control the entire seacoast, so they control the fishing, and anything else as far as exporting is controlled by whites. They say that if the wealth in Namibia were distributed equally, the people in Namibia would be the wealthiest in all of Africa. But of course, 10% of the people owning 87% of the land do not make for an equal distribution of wealth. Just like the United States, the whites oppress the black people, pushing them into reservations called Bantustans. If you look at your map again, you will find that there are 9 of them. The apartheid system says that every race or every tribe must live in the specific Bantustan where their ancestors are. They were herded into these different areas. All the rest of the country is called the police state. That means white folks only can live there, and if you're black and you want to get out of your Bantustan to go to work or to visit or anything like that, you can do so only with permission from the South African government and with the possibility of having a passbook. The Passbook Act is strictly to keep track of the blacks. It's a 90-page book that's very difficult for an African to carry around. They don't have a pocket. They don't carry purses. It gives their dental record. It tells the tribe that they're from. It tells the Bantustan that they live in. It tells who they married, what their work permit is. You are subject to arrest if you do not carry a passbook, and that's very, very awkward for the blacks to do. Ovambaland in the north has 350,000 people. Most of them are Lutheran. By the way, 80% of the people in Namibia, 80 to 90% are Christian, 58% of them are Lutheran. The next largest group is Roman Catholic, then Anglican, and some other denominations. But 58% of the people in Namibia are Lutheran, so that's why another reason why it's a special concern to us, or should be. Some of the Bantustans don't even have any water. Herero land, for instance, is 4/5 desert. They have one well, I'm told. They cannot possibly eke out a living because the Bantustans have no resources. All the good farming land is in the police state where the white people live. In order to work, you must become part of the labor contract system. That means that all the men leave, let's just take Ovambaland as an example. You leave Ovambaland, you go down to work in the American-controlled Newmont, American Climax company that has called the Tsumi Mine. In order to work in the copper mine, you must be away from your family for 6 to 12 months without being able to go back to see them. Men live in dormitories and they sleep on a cement slab. They're fed out of metal dishes that are anything but attractive. The food is vile. I have a book of poetry by some Namibians where they describe the conditions working for the Newmont Mining Company. It's a terribly inhumane, violent thing to do to men, to take them away from their families for a year at a time, and you can imagine the kinds of problems that arise when you get these men living together in these bleak dormitories for so long. You are assigned, according to your health, to be an A, B, or C worker, and that's the only way you can get a job. The C workers, which are supposedly the weakest men and can't tolerate being down in the mines, are sent to be sheep herders for Caracol sheep. We have those sheep imported to the United States, and they're called Persian lamb, and that's where we get our Persian lamb coats. $5.5 million a year comes into the pockets of the South African people through the herding or through the sale of the Caracol sheep. The sheep, to get the skin, the lambs are killed, and their very new furry little wool, or however I can describe it, is what is called Persian lamb. The meat is not even allowed to be given to blacks, so malnutrition is very, very extensive among the sheep herders. They have very little food to eat. They earn about $5 a month. The uranium mines in Namibia are very new. The British companies own most of the uranium mines. It's very important, of course, in our development of weapons. There are no health standards set for the blacks that work there. There is no health examination. The radiation from the refuse simply is dumped behind the houses of the people who live around there, and health hazards are very, very high. The mine, the Tsumi Copper Mine, where many of our Lutheran brothers work, was purchased in 1964 for $3 million, and it now earns yearly $17 million. And yet, the people that work there, according to the latest figures, 80% of them eke out a living with an income below the poverty line that was set by the South African government for a family of four. A black in the mines or in any working condition in Namibia is never allowed to supervise a white. A white in the same job gets 10 times more money than the black in that same job. Namibia is very, very good for American business. Our investments worldwide bring us about 10.8% return when we invest throughout the world. In Namibia, the return of investment is over 18%. Heavy investors in Namibia are Mobil Oil, Chase Manhattan Bank, Citibank, where we get our Visa card, Ford, Chrysler's, Del Monte. Purina is simply ignoring the United Nations plea and resolution not to fish offshore in Namibia because they are simply taking all of the fish out of the sea and not replenishing them. Purina continues to do that to make cat food for our cats. American oil companies include Gulf, Texaco. So America does have a lot of investments in Namibia as well as British companies. It is a very, very profitable thing for us to be there. But more about the apartheid system. The Terrorism Act was passed simply to say to somebody that was politically suspect, we don't want you on the streets anymore. According to the Terrorism Act that was passed not too many years ago by South Africa, you can take anybody off the street, hold them incommunicado without telling anybody where they are, and they can be imprisoned and they simply disappear from the streets of Namibia. The Internal Security Act is an act that allows people to be banned, B-A-N-N-E-D. If you write or speak against the government of South Africa, you can be banned, and that means that you cannot speak with more than three people at a time, and you cannot write or have anything published. 161 people at latest count are banned because they are politically suspect. Education is free and mandatory for whites. Blacks, it is not mandatory for, and they must pay in order to go to school. There is one teacher for every 19 white students, one teacher for every 48 black students. Health care is abominable as far as blacks are concerned. The ratio of doctors per whites in Namibia is the highest of any place in the world, one for every 400 whites. For the blacks, there is one doctor for every 44,000 black citizens of Namibia. One half of the children of Namibia die before they reach the age of five, and 55,000 people die each year of tuberculosis. Torture, according to Amnesty International, is just simply accepted. The government practices it regularly. We have Lutheran pastors who have been tortured. Lutherans have reported to their pastors that they have been put in metal cages in the middle of a town square with electric batons put to the groin of people. Stood there in these cages under hot, bitter sun, not able to sit, not able to go to the bathroom, not able to eat for days at a time. Because of all these things that are happening, and you can follow the dates on this sheet, the times that Southwest Africa has simply ignored the United Nations, we are now down to the year 1983, and in 1978, after the International Court of Justice had declared that South Africa was illegally in Namibia and had to get out, and they continued to ignore this International Court of Justice, the UN resolutions. Finally, five Western nations, including the United States, Germany, Canada, France, and Great Britain, got Resolution 435 passed through the United Nations. That calls for the withdrawal of South African troops, it calls for free elections, and it calls for the release of all political prisoners. Nothing has happened since 1978 except that these things have been hashed and rehashed and discussed, and now the United States has thrown a monkey wrench into the whole thing by insisting on the withdrawal of Cuban troops from Angola before Namibia has free elections and the South African government withdraws. The Lutheran World Ministries just put out a sheet at the beginning of this year. It deplores the constructive engagement policy of the United States government, which, and then they list the things which the United States government is doing right now to keep the oppression and the South African government and the apartheid system in Namibia. The United States has renewed their training of South African naval personnel at U.S. Coast Guard stations. We have received South African military personnel on official visits. We have established new South African consulates in the United States. We have permitted official visits by U.S. diplomats to so-called Bantustans or homelands. We have permitted the sale of specialized equipment and aircraft to South Africa, which can be employed by the military, and also we have sold them electric batons to be used by the South African police on demonstrators. We have protected South Africa by a veto in the Security Council after South Africa illegally invaded Angola. And that was just recently. When South Africa went through Namibia, through Ovamboland, they went into Angola to invade there because they see Zimbabwe going, not being able to be controlled. They see a lot of the states, the South African countries above Namibia, as a communist threat. And they see Namibia as the final buffer zone between them and, quote unquote, the communists. So when Lutheran World Ministries is this strong on a subject, I think that we need also to continue to look at it. A couple more things. SWAPO was begun by a man named Tavio, I think that's his name. It's the Southwest African People's Organization. It is now officially recognized by the United Nations as the official government of Namibia. It is mostly made up of people who have lived in Ovamboland. Bishop Cleophas Dumeni, our bishop up there, is his son coming on staff this summer?
I don't think so. I hope that he'll come for it at the end of the summer.
Oh, we were hoping to have Bishop Dumeni's son here. That would have been marvelous. Bishop Dumeni is frequently asked, are your people communists? You know, what SWAPO is, the South African police come in and they disturb the church services, the Lutheran services, they walk in, they look around, they examine footprints, they kick the men, they take them away to prison, the women and the children are treated very roughly, the husbands and brothers disappear without the women knowing where they're going, and the South African police say it's because we're looking for SWAPO communists, and Bishop Dumeni and he says, I have yet to see a communist in Ovamboland. I don't even know what a communist is. So many of the SWAPO people who are fighting, and they do use some violent means, they have remained nonviolent for years and years. Now they are taking up arms to defend themselves. Many have gone over into the neighboring countries of Botswana and Angola. In 1978, on March 4th, the South African government went in and killed 600 people, refugees, in Angola. Kasinga, that's in Angola, isn't it? Or Botswana, mm-hmm. Angola. Most of them were women and children. 400 others were badly wounded, and they were simply put into a huge open trench with dirt thrown over them. I think I'll quit by reading one poem from this book about what it feels like when our Lutheran missionaries or when missionaries come to this country. It's called The Old Namibian Peasant. It's written by a Namibian SWAPO member who is out in exile, the old Namibian peasant. He is a man of 100 summers, his back bent with age, his corrugated face screamed the hardship of life in a small round hut thatched with dry grass and reed back in the remotest rural areas. There he dwells with wife and children. He remembers well, though with pain, the younger days of his life when he was forced to lead an alien life and to surrender his labor to the colonists. He recalls with new freshness his neck veins glistened with sweat, his back, black muscular back, and his hands tough as leather. He held land then, he possessed cattle then, he possessed labor, all was under his control. But as you know, sister, time came and time went. Christianity came and colonialism followed, and he waited to see. From the Bible in his hand, the missionary preached the holy message, but with a gun in his pocket, the missionary killed his converts. The chiefs were exhorted into treaties, and he, dispossessed of his land and his cattle confiscated, stands here today, exploited and humiliated. He recalls with considerable pride and respect the men of courage who resisted. That is what his memory still recalls. Missionaries' wickedness, colonizers' cold-bloodedness, and Africans' resistance and bitter suffering. His face expresses now a clear, significant feature. We have offered resistance, and our children will carry on the just struggle until every inch of our soil is liberated. Or as another African put it, once we had the land, and you had the Bible. Now we have the Bible, and you have our land.
Well, Mary has covered so much in a short time. I need not say much more, and then we'll have time for discussion. Why Namibia? For two reasons. One, the Reagan administration has made the Namibia question the centerpiece of its African policy. So that's one reason. As citizens of this nation, we ought to know about that. As Mary indicated, there was a shift in administration policy towards South Africa when Ronald Reagan was elected president, and that was a shift to what is called a constructive engagement. The basic notion there is that while we have consistently declared our abhorrence of apartheid, the Reagan administration said the best way to fight apartheid is not with the stick, in a confrontative style, a la Andrew Young and President Carter, but with the carrot. And thus there has been a warming up to the government of South Africa in the hopes that by offering something to the government of South Africa from the United States, we could use that leverage to promote the independence of Namibia. Very beginning, as soon as the administration took office, it said that the independence of Namibia was the aim of the United States policy in Africa and a high priority. Now we can discuss whether the particular strategy there is an effective one. It has been very bogged down of late, and we can discuss why that is. But why Namibia? One answer to that is that our administration has said that it is the centerpiece of its African policy. And secondly, the church connection, Mary has highlighted that. I only want to add that the ALC, the LCA, and the AELC, the bodies that are now making up the merger move to the new church, have decided at national levels to undertake a major advocacy program about Namibia. We've been involved all along because of the connections between the Lutheran Church there and our own Lutheran denominations here.
a major decision was for a major campaign on the part of the Lutheran churches in this country, looking toward the 84 elections in the United States, to bring that issue of Namibia up. No one, we're not naive. We don't think that the American public is going to be making up its mind about who is going to elect to Congress on the basis of stands on Namibia. It's more an advocacy, constituency education. Get the issue out, let people know about it. So you will be hearing much more from the Lutheran churches here in the near future than in the past on Namibia. That's another reason we ought to talk about it at Bolden Village.
I want to add one word and we'll kick the conversation over. It's difficult, as Mary pointed out, to separate Namibia, to isolate Namibia from the question of South African apartheid. And one of the things that I'd really like to put forward, I think it's important for Christians to consider, is that apartheid in South Africa is, yes, a legal system of the separation of races. Yes, it is a policing system for the separation of the races, filled with the worst and most abhorrent kinds of violence. But equally important to us, as well as the Christian community, is that the South African government legitimates its policy of apartheid theologically and biblically, claims it as the will of God as has been revealed in Jesus Christ. And that makes it not only all of those other issues, but it makes it for us a faith issue, a fundamental faith issue as well. It really asks us to raise the question and clear it and clarify it in our minds, is what just is the gospel? What is the biblical message, particularly as it relates to this worldwide phenomenon of racism? So I just want to throw that into the pot before we open up the conversation. We haven't said much about ways of caring, but maybe that'll come out. Okay, I assume the floor is yours for now.
Well, sorry, this is the chance to embellish upon that last issue. In addition to South African apartheid, the Mormon Church, Latter-day Saints, and several other churches, I believe, have justified a certain degree of racism on the basis of Scripture. What are their Scripture references so that we know better how to fight them?
The theological basis for apartheid is a fairly complex and extensive interpretation of the whole of the biblical narrative. But to do a little bit of embellishment, but to cut it short, Mary mentioned the Four Trekkers, who made this move from the southern part of South Africa into the more inland regions. In the course of doing that, these were all Dutch Reformed Calvinist Christians who made this move. In the course of doing it, they took the biblical message, the biblical narrative, and used it as an interpretive piece for their own life, interpreting themselves as the Israelites moving out of Egypt, i.e. the southern part of Africa dominated by Pharaoh, i.e. the British, moving into the new promised land, the inland regions of South Africa, where they encountered the Canaanites, that is, the black folks who were already there. Okay. And then taking all the kinds of Old Testament law that kept the Israelites in separation from the Canaanites, that became their interpretive device. Now, there's a lot more to it, but that won't...
That's certainly the history. It's the parallel of the conquest of the land of Canaan and the sense of being a chosen people. The present day elaboration by conservative Dutch Reformed theologians, Dr. Connor theologians in South Africa, is one that sounds very much like the same talk that we use. It is a celebration of pluralism. That God created many peoples, and it is in the flowering of creation that different ethnic traditions and racial traditions should celebrate what that created those created differences. So the language now is not even apartheid. It's the separate development of peoples, and the kind of the key favorite word now is pluralism and what that has to offer. What is always neglected in that is, of course, the situation that Mary described. The power is not shared.
I think before we just throw stones always at South Africa, that again, that civil religion, that seeing America saw itself as the new Israel, and crossing the Red Sea was crossing the ocean to come over here. And I mean, all of the biblical parallels of Old Testament redemption stories are seen in our history too.
The big difference now, though, is that, and this was remarked to me time and time again by friends in South Africa, is that apartheid is a consistent effort to legalize racism, to make it the law of the land. The difference from that from the United States is that the laws have operated to move away from institutionalized racism rather than to entrench it.
I don't know, it's probably just a question of the apartheid, but there was recently, I think maybe that's a case of chance, that I saw quite a long documentary on this South African thing. They showed where the workers were lived, you know, on the whole bit, the homes, you know, land they came from. And it was not too many weeks, maybe 3 weeks the most back that I saw it.
Yeah, one of the things, I guess, I think that we need to be a little bit careful of, it's pretty easy for good to go bad. I mean, I guess is one of the things, and that is that it's easy to kind of target South Africa, turn South Africa into a sort of a whipping boy, you know, and sort of you know, stroke your finger and shame and get really aggressive. But then one of the things that Mary has pointed out that we really need to take seriously is that South Africa is not an island all by itself there. So we're talking about benefit of this system very close to home for American people. Those of us who are sitting in the room right now are beneficiaries in some way of South African apartheid. I think that's important. So I don't want to just, again, you know, hold it up and start beating on South Africa, making them bad boys, and that there's a place in which I think we've got to come clean.
Both the ALC and LCA voted at their conventions to divest, or if they wanted to. Well, Larry, why don't you speak to that? Because you went to the, is it Mobil Oil Board meeting?
I was at the Xerox meeting. But first of all, just a word about the divestment. The ALC has voted a policy of divestment, that is to remove the monies that it has in the forms of stocks from those companies which do business in South Africa. However, it is in fact a policy of selective divestment because of a particular rule or law called the prudent trustee law, which says that you cannot remove your money from a company when you are holding, or you cannot as an investor and dealing with other people's money now, remove your money from a company if you cannot reinvest it in a way that does not take any greater risks economically with that money. So the ALC has taken money out of companies where it has invested it, only that are doing business in South Africa, only when it is reasonably sure it can invest in some other companies which do not do business in South Africa. So it's a kind of selective investment.
Let's start a fight.
No, wait a minute. The LCA convention decision is also a divestment decision, but it's not even quite that strong. Divestment is one strategy. The other strategy, another strategy with respect to the corporations, is to file stockholder resolutions. You do own shares. You do not divest. You're still a stockholder in the case where I was, Xerox. And then you try then from, as a stockholder, to get changes in corporation policy in South Africa. So the ALC, for example, was the chief filer of a stockholder resolution this year that asked the Xerox to quit selling its products to the police and the military of South Africa. That was basically information processing machinery, as you can well imagine, computers and the like. Management said no to that, so it then, but it was a resolution filed, so then it was put to the stockholders. They voted then, they knew management's position on it, and the stockholders voted 94%, Xerox ought to continue to sell to the police and military. South Africa, 6% of the stockholders said no, or should not.
Do you have to have a majority vote in a stockholder meeting?
Oh, just but that never happened.
I know. I mean, how much stock would a church have to have in order, would they have to have
50%? You'd have to have 51% in order.
So what is
the vote? Not,
in?
You don't have to have control of stock. If for a stock resolution to go through, you have to have 51% vote. That never happened. It's a matter of it's an effort to get, if you get a high enough percentage, say 10%, 15%, the management is much more likely to think about making those changes without it becoming a matter of public record. And they may do that even before a resolution is filed. You may be able to go to them and say, okay, we'll do this and we'll do that. That has happened too. But those are two.
Does the percentage of that vote on it demonstrate the argument that the best strategy is to stay inside the corporation? Or do you think there's still hope that that can be effective?
Well, that's a little hard to trace because a lot of corporations that do business in South Africa have, in fact, made a number of significant changes. They've signed the Solon Principles, which is more justice in the workplace, etc. And you can say that's because of both stockholder resolutions and the threat of divestment. Now, the divestment strategy has taken a turn. It had its origins in the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, which is a way in which the church is coordinate their investment or their strategies over against the corporation. It has now moved from the churches to some very large agents, the State of California Pension Fund, for example. The State of California, under Jerry Brown, it may have changed now, but under Jerry Brown, the State of California decided that it would not do business with the pension funds, would not do business with corporations that did business in South Africa. Recently, the state of Connecticut said it would not invest state monies in corporations that did business in South Africa. So the combination of a strategy which involves both stockholder resolutions and a disinvestment policy has probably made for some significant changes.
I want to take my argument. I want to start.
I want to do that too. I'm the Panther. They're talking
about. I don't want to get my fight in. I think the prudent man. I think the prudent man rules the roost. And the divestment by California and Connecticut demonstrate that it's a ruse. Back in 1977, 78, the Wisconsin State legislature divested. And they were very queasy about this so-called prudent man rule. And so they went through a whole big quantity of research. And they produced a volume about year thick, demonstrating that that there were all kinds of alternative investments that were available to folks that would produce better returns than the South African stocks would produce. I can tell you that the documentation is in the hands of both the LCA and the ALC because I put them there. So I know those folks know that. So I'm going to assume rule crap. That's a ruse. There's something else going on. I think it is in the case of the LCA. In the case of the LCA, they don't like grassroots ideas, and they didn't have the idea in the first place, so that's why they resented. I don't know what it is in the case of the ALC. I don't do that. But that's one thing I want to state. I mean, I think the prudent man rule is a ruse. Secondly, I want Larry to tell me one significant change in policies. A significant change that has created, in fact, freedom for black folks. I know changes about, getting ceramic dishes instead of tin dishes in dormitories, and getting hay mats instead of slabs, concrete slabs to sleep on. But that's what gets called petty apartheid, huh? You can now drink at the same water fountain. You get permission from the government to sleep on straw. That was a significant change, Larry.
Well, I don't think there has been significant change. I was trying to pass along the point, the way of argument of those who call up that strategy. They would say some of the changes have been significant.
Which strategy are you talking about now?
The combination of disinvestment and stockholder resolution getting changed by appealing to management, property management, and so on.
I don't see divestment as a strategy. I think it's on the one hand an act of witness, but more importantly than that, it's an act of solidarity, because the most articulate struggling black leadership in South Africa and Namibia have said, please divest.
How much divestment would it take? Do you know how much money is invested in that country? I mean, from all sources, when they talk about divestment, it's fine, but how much investment is, how much in dollars do you have to divest in order to really reach it?
We can talk about that. It won't happen.
I know, but
there aren't corporations that are going to be hurt by divestment.
By churches.
Yeah, by churches.
We have $1.5 billion.
People starting to do it. What would it take?
We have $1.5 billion.
You have to go to about 2 stockholders and their meetings to realize it's not going to happen. It is a witness, and it is an act of solidarity. The way to go, if you want to appeal to corporations for change, is to say, look, the future of South Africa is going to be in the hands of the majority. Now, what side do you want to be on when that majority comes to power?
More than 300 U.S. companies have significant operations in South Africa. In 1980, the total U.S. investment was $2.1 billion.
The British would exceed that. The United States is not the largest.
I think the United States is third. Germany.
Yeah, Germany would
Germany,
be more than
Britain
yeah,
and the United States.
The United States. Question or comment?
Well, no, just we talk about divestment as a way of influencing corporations, but I think that we tend to forget that the corporation is made up of people, and the leaders are much more sensitive to, I think, the other approach, which is to keep going to the stockholders meeting and to make a lot of public pressure. The people that I've known at the higher level of corporate management are most sensitive to public pressure,
yes,
not to divestment. Other people will buy the stocks and
make
money.
That's what I'm saying. If you can't go buy the stock, I mean...
Yeah, that's what I said. It has nothing to do with strategy.
Mm-hmm.
would never advocate that as a strategy.
Yeah, that's not.
Yeah.
But sometimes you just have to stand and say, I'm not going to be a part of this anymore. I mean,
as a witness, I can understand that, that side, but as a strategy, I find it.
But if we're called to be faithful and not make history come out right, then is that a faith stance? Is that a faithful thing to do and not worry about, is it going to be effective? I don't know if that's tough.
Would the ALC, ALCA, be a party to taking these funds that they have invested in stocks and applying that to program in those countries? Evidently, that's surplus money that they don't need.
No.
It's mostly pension funds.
It's not a waste of money. It's a pension fund.
Any other pastors, ALC or LCA pastors in the room?
Yeah.
I heard a yeah, but I didn't see. Oh, well, you know, I mean, it's our money, John.
In fact, on the floor of the convention, they said that the trustees of the American Lutheran Church could be sued if they didn't get the highest possible dollar with those funds. And not only that was the argument that they almost that you can't bring morality into it. And I said, well, the pension funds for a long time did not invest in alcohol or tobacco, so our piety, if it is morality, our piety said that we wouldn't invest in something no matter what the returns were, and nobody ever sued them for that. And I thought human rights in Namibia was as important as booze as a moral issue, and we defeated his argument.
Well, but if a church in convention says, I really don't care if my pension money doesn't draw the greatest possible amount of return, isn't that giving permission for the trustees to, I mean, who's going to sue if the body of which you are a part says, I want to do this?
In Minnesota, it's a state law. The church can't.
The what?
In Minnesota, the prudent trustee is a state law. I mean, where ALC is headquartered must abide by that law because it's a state law. It's not a church law.
Yeah, right.
But if the people who control the funds, namely us, the church, says, we don't care, how can that, isn't there a higher rule than the law of Minnesota? I mean, I don't.
Did Xerox make the prudent investor law? Whose idea was that? That law is
to protect whoever you're holding
the funds. Well, to protect your, it's allegedly to protect your investors, but it doesn't do a thing about a witness such as this.
No. But the law was, in Minnesota, if you give a four-year-old your inheritance and you trust someone else to invest the money for that four-year-old, that they will do the best possible for that four-year-old. I think that was the aspect at which the Minnesota legislature was looking at it when he did it, as opposed to this issue, which I'm sure didn't enter into their mind.
What is it about, I don't know, it seems like, what are we talking about in Namibia, I can't say anything. What are we supposed to be doing? I mean,
the thing, first of all, this is a marvelous sheet of paper. If you, on that blue sheet, you can write to Namibian Concerns at Warburg-Sam if you want to send funds or something. But basically, they will send you a newsletter, or you could ask for the Strategies for Action on Namibia. You can get 100 of them for $5 and give them out to your congregation. Prayer, education, most people. How many people here knew about Namibia before we started talking?
I think our LCW should send books there. Okay, for a long time.
This is a bigger percentage of people who've ever heard of Namibia at Holden. Usually out of 50 people, maybe 5 hold up their hands as knowing anything about it. Support for the Namibian church itself. If you write letters to Bishop Cleophas Domeni, whose name is on your blue sheet, every letter is opened by the South African government. And it helps the support of the church in Namibia to know that there are Lutherans. It's one way that Lutheran bishops who were put on a hit list and were just systematically being exterminated until the capital of or the Windhoek paper in Namibia listed all the people. They got the list, who was on the hit list, and it included a lot of Lutheran leaders. Then the killing stopped. But to know, for the South African government to know that there is support from the United States, from individual people, I write to Bishop Demeny a couple times a year just to say, I'm talking about your church and your country and I'm praying for you. And I know it doesn't probably make a hoot of difference, but it does to me, and it might, because South African government, all those letters, the bishop tells us, are put in a big basket, and at festival times during the church services, they read, just pick at random, a bunch of letters. And that is a marvelous support for these people, for the bishop who has a cannon aimed at his house, and where the roads are mined and you can't drive over them and you can't attend church service if you live too far away because there's a curfew and you can be imprisoned if you're not back in your house by dusk. That kind of support is very important. So don't minimize writing letters to the Ovambo Kavango Lutheran Church in Namibia. The fourth thing they talk about is political advocacy. Again, I did put some of the names and addresses that you could write to. Continue to write letters to the ambassador from South Africa, to Botha, the prime minister, to your congressman, congresswoman, to your senator, to say that this is of concern to you. And the main thing you can say right now is, dear senator, please see that the United States does not continue to put on to any withdrawal of South African troops or any election in Namibia the premise that all of the Angolan troops, that all of the Cuban troops in Angola must be withdrawn. That's frankly none of our business, I don't think. Angola asked the Cuban troops to come in there when South Africa invaded them. And, I mean, that's not an easy situation either. But if you feel strongly about that, that's one thing you can say. So call, write letters, write to the editor of your newspaper, all that kind of political advocacy, economic pressure. We really, some of the strategies from the church bodies have been to insist that the United States put economic sanctions. Money talks. If we put economic sanctions on South Africa, we think that would do something.